first time with my family, who visited the hospital in one or two at a time combinations. I'm anxious to see them all at the same time. Back in Manhattan, Tracy and Nina unload the car while I'm rolled into our building to find Esme waiting for me in the lobby. I haven't seen her in 3 weeks. Being a sophomore in high school, homework and other commitments prevented her from visiting the hospital in Maryland. She's not sure how to approach me, other than gently, so she leans in with a soft hug. I notice that the doorman, Sonny and Danny, have placed a temporary wheelchair ramp over the two short flights of stairs leading to the elevator. I turn to Esme and ask, "Who in the building has a wheelchair?" She pauses for a second and then with a slight tilt of her head, "You?" My daughter takes my hand as I'm wheeled into the elevator. When the door opens onto the foyer of our apartment, she says, "I know you can't smell them, but I'm baking brownies for you. I gotta make sure they're not burning." With that, she pushes through the swinging door to the kitchen. As she goes in, Gus pads out into the dining room. Hearing my voice, he turns his head and trots toward me. When I don't rise out of the chair to meet him, he slows his approach, his demeanor suddenly guarded. Gus circles the wheelchair, taking great huffing sniffs, and places himself in the chair's path. He makes it clear that he dislikes and distrusts the contraption. He fixes me with his droopy eyes and does a hound dog's low whine, punctuated by quiet, plaintive woofs. "Stand up. Stand up." I make fun of people who lie to their pets. "I'm going to the store. I'll be right back." Even though you know you'll be gone for hours. "We're not going to the vet." "That's exactly where you're going." We all do it. I try not to, but when I reach out to Gus from the chair and tell him, "I'm okay," we both know I'm lying. The center hallway in our apartment ends in a T, the master bedroom to the right, and to the left a small spare bedroom that over the years has become my realm, my den. Now repurposed for convalescence, it is barely recognizable. A hospital room, but with carpets and my own books on the shelves. My bathroom is reconfigured with strategically placed grip bars. Within the glass and marble shower enclosure are more grip bars. And, gleaming under the overhead light, a chrome and plastic chair. A sadly appropriate throne for a damaged king returning from battle. Same war, different front. The rehab program at Mount Sinai has earned a reputation similar to that of Johns Hopkins. It's a smaller facility and not quite as elaborately equipped, but as I'm about to learn, something as basic as an oversized rubber band or a stack of red Solo cups can be a dynamic tool in the hands of a skilled therapist. And I soon meet that therapist. Will, a tall, slender man in his 30s, greets me on the third floor. He has a friendly face, impeccable posture, and what has to be a theatrically trained voice. Will approaches my wheelchair. I stand to shake his hand, but it's difficult, and I begin to pitch forward. In extending his hand and grasping mine, he steadies me into full standing position. "I'm Mike," I say. "Sorry, I'm a little wobbly. My internal gyroscope is out of whack." "Your proprioception is way off. Let's see what we can do about that." The word proprioception derives from the Latin proprius, meaning individual or one's own, and capere, meaning to take or grasp. It is the sense of the relative position of one's own body parts, and the strength of effort being employed in any movement. Some people refer to it as their sixth sense. Others would say, it's where I am in space. I can barely pronounce it, but I can't apply the word to my experience. From our first meeting, Dr. Theodore had explained that I should expect problems with my proprioception after surgery, specifically altering my equilibrium and stability. He framed it this way. If your proprioception is impaired, you have the sensation, for example, that you can't stand in a dark room without falling over. I hadn't anticipated that it would be this confusing and disorienting. Will continues his evaluation. "And of course you have Parkinson's too," he says, "which already impairs your ability to walk at baseline." I affect a shocked expression. "I have Parkinson's?" Most days I travel to and from treatment at Mount Sinai by wheelchair. I hold my walker on my lap while Belinda, my current health aide and pilot, swerves in and out of pedestrian traffic on the Upper East Side. There's a certain entitlement that comes with the job of being the wheelchair pusher. Belinda takes up as much space and goes as fast or slow as Belinda wants, no matter how many people are blocking her path. She uses me as a blunt instrument to hack her way through the crowd. I can't help but think that some little old lady is going to be run over and the last face she'll see will be mine. Sam, Tracy, and Nina often walk with us. We are a tiny parade, same time, same route, same show, winding its way to the hospital. If only we had giant balloons and a float. I don't like sitting in a wheelchair, but as a practical matter, given Manhattan's grid of one-way streets, the distance traveled from my apartment to the outpatient rehab facility a few blocks away is more easily accomplished this way than by vehicle. Even so, there is a vulnerability and an exposure that comes with being seen in a wheelchair in public. This is a new experience for me, one I would rather have skipped. In truth, I think more attention is paid to the chair than the person riding in it, even by those who begrudgingly make way for it. The exception is when they're in danger of being run over by a wheelchair, which is often the case, given Belinda's bulldozer technique. Asses and elbows. We refer to people in wheelchairs as wheelchair-bound. What does that mean exactly? Wheelchair-bound suggests that one is bound to the chair, held hostage. It contains you. Perhaps the person is used to mobility and the unrestricted use of their body parts, looks at the chair as a concession, an instrument of surrender. Whereas, to one who is disabled to a point where independent movement is not an option, the chair is a means of freedom to move. I relate to the concept that this way of moving around is a reality of my future. As in, I'm bound for a wheelchair. At some point, using a wheelchair is a likelihood. It's only a question of when. In the past year or two, I've used one sparingly under certain circumstances to save time and energy. I'm relieved to have access to it whenever I need to cross a vast amount of space in a short amount of time. On trips overseas, for example, airport transfers make a wheelchair essential. Unless I know the person who is pushing me in the wheelchair, it can be a frustrating and isolating experience, allowing someone else to determine the direction I'm going and the rate of speed I can travel. The pusher is in charge. From the point of view of the occupant of the chair, it's a world of asses and elbows. There's something, too, about a wheelchair that has an effect on my voice. No one can hear me. To compensate, I raise my voice, and suddenly I feel like Joan Crawford in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, barking out orders. But no one is listening. For someone who's used to having mobility and a sense of free will, being in the wheelchair is completely the opposite. I am at the mercy of the person steering me. They will put me in a corner or up against a wall, and I'll have no say in it. I can hear something I want to respond to, but I can't turn around and see it. Generally, the person in control is a stranger, an airport or hotel employee. I'm sure that if we could ever look each other in the eye, we'd recognize our mutual humanity. But often in the wheelchair, I'm luggage. I'm not expected to say much, just sit still. Delivery to my destination is just another task to be finished in their busy day. On a recent trip, going through airport security in a wheelchair was excruciating. If I stayed in the chair, I couldn't go through the scanner. I had to pull off to one side and be subjected to a thorough pat-down, then wait while the wheelchair was meticulously swabbed and examined. My attendant was surprised when I suggested it would be much easier if I just walked through the scanner. He couldn't seem to comprehend that the wheelchair was provisional. I don't consider it necessary, an important distinction that is often lost on those who steer. I can walk, I just can't walk far. That's why I used the chair. He wasn't hearing it. I don't walk quickly or efficiently, but I have my cane and I can make the decision when to use the chair. You can't explain that to everybody. When you stand and actually start to take steps, it's as if no one around you wants to believe it. He can walk. Once they've seen the wheelchair, they believe you're immobile. I used my cane to approach the scanner and then handed that off to a TSA employee before I went through, picked it up on the other side, and used it for support until the chair came through. It was clear that rising from the chair and demonstrating the ability to operate independently rattled my handler. "Here, get in the chair," he insisted. "I'm all right, I just want to stretch my legs for a minute." That left him befuddled. "But here's the chair," he repeated. I would have liked to be vertical for a few more minutes, but I felt obliged to climb back in the chair of silence and be delivered to the gate. No one listens to luggage. You don't know what you got till it's gone. I have to learn to walk again, to reclaim my mobility, remaster my motion. I consider this fundamental to my therapy. For me, it all starts and ends with walking. And I understand that it's more complicated than that. So many tiny disciplines have to be observed, and neglected muscles and ligaments need to be restored. I'm exhausted by the effort I already put in at Johns Hopkins and daunted by how much work I still have to do. It's like being needled to death by ducks. Back in the days of carefree ambling, I would have considered the topic of walking to be rather pedestrian. Now the acts of stepping, strolling, hiking, and perambulating have become an obsession. I watch Esme gliding through the kitchen, grabbing an apple while opening the fridge door for a coconut water, closing it with a quick shift of her hip and pirouetting at the swinging door at the other end of the room. Down in the lobby, my neighbor and her daughter are quick-stepping to catch a taxi. I spy on a man walking with a slight limp, which he counterbalances with a bag of groceries. I secretly watch the way they all move. Easy, breezy, cat-like or with a limp. Every one of them is far better at it than me. It may be that the most difficult, miraculous thing we do physically is to walk. It's one of the first things on the agenda, and we do it before we realize how impossible the whole exercise is. Tracy and I have 4 children. We know the drill. My mind can pull up images of Sam, for example, at age 1. With a pat on the butt, I sent him trucking across the living room rug. I counted each tiny footfall. After some confident toddling, Sam reached the edge of our ottoman coffee table. His knees buckled momentarily. He took a breath, steadied himself, his oversized head wobbling, and broke away from his support. Suddenly standing alone with nothing around him but a sea of carpet, he saw Tracy waiting for him. He quickened his step, stumbled, and fell into her arms. Now, on occasion, her husband does the same thing. It's uncanny how this memory loop of Sam's first steps mirrors my situation post-surgery. I've heard that while learning how to walk, toddlers fall an average of 21 times an hour. In my sessions at Mount Sinai, I swear there are days when, if my physical therapist didn't catch me by the arm or shoulder or the scruff of the neck, I'd beat that average. That kind of physical rescue from an imminent fall is often mirrored by an emotional rescue in the form of support from my family. Tracy comes to every therapy session during the first week, and then continues to drop in and observe my progress in the weeks that follow, always with smiles, hugs, and words of encouragement. Sam doesn't miss many sessions either. He is wholly focused on each exercise, each repetition, each little victory over a particular challenge, and each temporary defeat. He never looks out the window, he never checks his cell phone. When I complain that something is difficult to do, he's always there with, "That's because you're old, Dad." Believe it or not, that makes me feel better. We all naturally adjust to obstacles and visual and physical stimuli in our own way. Since I can't anticipate or elude obstructions, I have to implement a regimen of self-observation and correction. I can't be sure without a visual check which foot I'm leaning with, left or right. I'm off balance if my head is too far forward or tilting too far back. I have to consider the mechanics of each movement. It's tough. With PD in the aftermath of surgery, something as simple as remaining upright is often sabotaged by a rogue army of misfiring neurons. I try to stay organized. I have memorized a litany of admonitions, not unlike my golfer's list of swing thoughts. Keep my head centered over my hips, hips over my knees, no hyperextending, stay in line with my feet, eyes forward, shoulders back, chest out, lead with the pelvis. All this kinetic vigilance can dissolve in a nanosecond of panic, or come apart with some other distraction. A tiny nervous jolt or spasm, and like a house of cards in a sudden gust of wind, the only messages that will make it through the debris are, don't fall. Don't fall, don't fall. Get up. Will to walk. When I first met my PT, Will, I immediately knew 2 things about the guy. 1, he was determined to get me walking again safely, and 2, he had been, at some point, an actor or performer. That voice. I ask him out of the blue if he still works on Broadway. I'm not surprised when he answers, "Nope, I gave it up, this pays better." Now I know he's smart, too. Will is focused on helping me develop my own system of kinetic priorities. The key to walking to the other side of the room is not being there, but getting there. I rise from chairs and lean forward to the point where I'm convinced I'll topple over on my face and break my nose. I pick up a beanbag from one end of a table, walk around a series of traffic cones to reach the other end, and put the beanbag in a cup. And then I sidestep around the tables with a stack of beanbags and do it all again. I'm over any curiosity as to why these specific exercises are beneficial. I figure they're too weird not to have a purpose. But Will explains it anyway. For him, PT is a serious endeavor, taken on with honorable aspirations. I feel a responsibility to him to succeed, just as I felt a responsibility to Dr. Theodore to not fall, injure my back, and damage his work. From the outset, Will gives my Parkinson's and spinal surgery equal weight, never dealing with the impact of one without acknowledging the complicating factor of the other. He's not a specialist. He can deal with whatever a patient presents, including my combination of problems. Will knows how to separate one condition from the other. Parkinson's dictates the speed and trajectory of my movement, while the stress in my spinal cord creates a lack of sensation and affects my proprioception. We work on the mechanics and kinetics of walking, with attention paid to both these issues. It's a complex algorithm, and there are no easy shortcuts. Over the next 2 months, we do everything from the basics, stretching, core work, getting in and out of chairs, to obstacle courses and ball tosses without toppling, all in pursuit of the Holy Grail, walking independently. I walk for miles in one little stretch of hallway on the 3rd floor at Mount Sinai, using a variety of different implements, a walker, 2 canes, then 1 cane. The truth is, I never master the cane. I have trouble negotiating on my own two legs, and now I have a third. How do I make this work? I'm captain of my own ship. I don't need an extra oar. I travel back and forth, always with some form of support. Hospital floors are hard surfaces, and even at 5'5", it's a long way down. In the doorways at each end of the hall, I experience tremendous stutter-stepping. Something about my PD hates crossing thresholds. It interrupts my progress and forces me to make a choice to continue. If I encounter someone while passing through a doorway, unable to avoid them, I freeze. Only when they move am I released. Twist and shout. There are other aspects to my spring and summer therapy at Mount Sinai, such as the occupational piece of it. More carrying, lifting, bathroom safety, bed making, and sock tugging. I take this seriously too, and I now manage to put my own socks on without mechanical intervention. Specifically related to my Parkinson's, I also participate in 5 weeks of speech therapy. It's common for Parkinson's patients, particularly during the later stages of their disease, to slur and mumble their words, or to experience problems speaking clearly and loudly enough for others to hear. I didn't think I would enjoy this additional therapy, but I do. Speaking loudly and clearly is more difficult than one would think. It's something new and different in rehab, and at least if I screw up, I don't fall down. My instructor, Siobhan, provides me with a list of words in different sequences and reads me snippets of prose, parts of which she quizzes me on after reading. I answer the questions or reorder the words, whatever is required. There's a bizarre element included in all of this. I'm in a small room 2 doors down from where 6 patients are working intently with their therapist, and I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. That's the secret of this therapy. It has to be at maximum volume in order to improve weakened vocal cords. Siobhan often gives me homework, and I complete the assignment by calling her answering service and shouting my results. Each day's work ends with her handing me a piece of journalism or some other literary material, which she asked me to belt out for all of Mount Sinai Hospital to enjoy. I receive today's piece of paper, and without delay, I rip into it. After 2 sentences, I realize that I'm sharing the exquisitely crafted words of my esteemed brother-in-law, Michael Pollan. The piece relates to his work on hallucinogens. That night, I pass on this information to Michael P., adding that I may have convinced someone with a broken hip to try psilocybin therapy. He's decidedly pleased. Chapter 13, A Crowded House. REM sleep brings strange nightmares and a few sweet dreams. In some, I can't move. I am paralyzed. In others, I'm as able-bodied as I was as a kid. This nocturnal brain activity seems normal, but what happens tonight is definitely abnormal. It's a waking dream. My eyes are open. I can't be seeing what I'm seeing. It's a hallucination, a delusion, an unwelcome flashback to my post-op mind warp. If I close my eyes and still see it, then I will know it's a nightmare. My eyes shut, and he's gone. Eyes open, he's there again, bigger and badder than ever, a hooded figure, his bearded face awash in green luminescence, looming at the foot of my bed. From my angle, he's a wizard, or Obi-Wan Kenobi, or maybe Satan, glowing in the dark. Then I get it. It's not the Dark Lord after all, it's just Frank. Frank's presence represents everything that is fucked up about my circumstance. Until you've experienced it, it's difficult to appreciate the creepiness of being observed while you sleep. Frank, a nice enough guy, is my nighttime aide. An avid biker, he parks his Harley in front of our building. He arrives at 8 p.m. and takes over from the day shift. This means I am never alone, and it is suffocating. Frank watches a hockey game with me, or puts up on my current binge, Peaky Blinders. At some point after I fall asleep, he ensconces himself in the recliner across from my bed in the den, pulls up the hood of his sweatshirt to shade his bearded jowls, and jams in his earbuds. His iPhone bathes his face in an eerie glow as he texts his wife. Every once in a while, he peers up to assure himself that I haven't spontaneously combusted. In the dead of the night, I stir awake and shudder. Emerging from half-sleep, I am dazed and confused by the presence of this hooded, cross-legged Beelzebub. He accepts my stare and asks, "Hey man, do you need to go pee?" And so it goes. At 8 a.m., the daytime home health aides arrive. After brushing my teeth and combing my hair, they help me dress, and we're on our way to the rehab facility. These aides are associates in a sort of enterprise, the business of restoring my health. They observe each day's therapy session and encourage my efforts. With today's rehab over, my aide Belinda wheels me down Madison Avenue's crowded sidewalks at a regular Indy 500 pace. "You're good in there today," she huffs, "but take your time, don't rush." The wheelchair bounces over a curb, and was that someone's foot? "Thanks, right back at you, Belinda." With dinner finished, the night shift takes over and stays with me until morning. I have the most grief with the nighttime aides. I'm sure they'd say the same about me. None of us are at fault, it's just that the whole premise is flawed. While the day shift seems invested in my recovery, the night shift attends to me as if I'm of an advanced age, infirm and disabled, a fragile hospice patient with limited prospects. Actually, that's not entirely fair. They're dedicated and capable health professionals who are concerned for my welfare. But the impression I get is that they just don't want me to fall on their watch. What is remarkable to me about this time period, from the ICU to rehab at Johns Hopkins and the return to New York for more physical therapy, is how microscopic my world has become. I'm a single-cell organism in a petri dish, under observation 24 hours a day. But this situation is far too intimate for my present disposition. I'm finally in my own home again, and my supreme goal, to get back on my feet and begin operating independently, runs counter to the objectives of the nocturnal occupying force, who want to limit my movement in this, my personal space. By design, the night aide's priority must be to avoid the slightest risk. Prevention, not progress. Parkinson's has robbed me of the luxury of spontaneity. I can't initiate any new activity without a careful assessment of my physical circumstance and mental alertness. Being observed so intensely, though, is a new kind of constriction. The surgery has rendered me unbearably dependent. I bristle at steadying hands that reach out to support me, by my judgment, most times unnecessarily. As I make my way to the bathroom, I'm watched over like a baby in a bathtub. My muttered objections soon escalate to audible complaints. I negotiate to be allowed at least a few cautious steps on my own. But as with the nurses at Johns Hopkins, my home aide's mandate is clear. No walking without assistance. Walks in the park. My days in physical therapy at Mount Sinai are a wholly different experience. Progress is made and measured, and I grow more confident that soon I'll be able to walk safely. I really want this, and with pride in the quality of my effort, I will go through any amount of pain or pressure to achieve my goal. With Will, my PT, the work is steady and intense. Out of frustration, I balk at certain exercises, but he insists that I persist. The inspiration I draw from the other patients in the facility is a big factor in my ability to push through. Many are in far more dire circumstances than me. Strokes, severe car accidents, spinal damage, loss of limbs. When needed, this is a shot of reality. All the while, my family, Nina and that day's aide, Belinda, or Marcus, a pleasant gentleman and a much more careful wheelchair pusher, are there to mark my progress and celebrate it with me. Eventually, after months of focused effort, I am free of it all. No walker, no cane. I'm able to manage the nighttime hours alone now, without an aide. When I close the bathroom door, I'm the only one inside of it. The daytime aides are still here, and they're helpful. They acknowledge my progress and encourage me towards independence. When I finish the prescribed therapy at Mount Sinai, I know I'll need to continue daily workouts at home. Will sends me off with good advice. Don't be in a hurry to get this done, he counsels. You have to be okay with taking a step back. This is a long process. You made an investment of blood, sweat, and tears in this therapy and spilled plenty of all three. But you have to keep at it. I'm sorry to tell you that the work never stops. It's not easy to hear, but I resolve to kick ass, even if it is my own. They say it's your birthday. Days after rehab ends, I celebrate my birthday. Tracy has gathered a dinner party in our apartment with five other couples. For many of these friends, I've been missing in action for the past 6 months, and they have questions about my experiences. I run through it for anyone who asks, and to my relief, their comments lean more toward, "You look good," than, "Looks like you had a rough time." So that's reassuring. After dinner, Tracy taps on her wine glass and rises to speak. I'm surprised because she doesn't often give toasts. Our eyes meet across the table. With a slight smile, I raise an eyebrow. "A toast? Really? Wow." She begins. "I know we're all here to wish Mike a happy birthday, but I want to say something else, too." She fixes her gaze on me and pauses. "Mike, this has been such a tough year for you. What you've been through is incredible. The surgery, rehab at Johns Hopkins, and Mount Sinai." And then to her friends around the table, "He has worked so hard. Every day, day after day, he had to learn to walk all over again. He is amazing." Her eyes come back to me and she smiles. Not that he isn't still a pain in the ass sometimes. That makes me laugh. Guilty, I interject. She raises her glass. I'm so proud of you, Michael. We all are. The kids, everybody. We love you. I love you, and I believe in you. Happy birthday. May the next year be a little easier for all of us. Everyone raises their glass, and I tip mine towards Tracy. I hope through all the clinking and birthday wishes, she hears me. I love you, too. 3 years prior, on my 54th birthday, Tracy surprised me with an incredible gift. Presenting it to me required us to make a stop en route to my celebratory dinner. Although our reservation was at a restaurant down in Greenwich Village, Tracy asked the car to turn uptown, and it led us out at the 105th Street entrance to Central Park. She took my hand as we crossed through the gates of the Conservatory Garden, one of my favorite spots in the city. Many long walks with Gus have included a stop at one of the benches here, which overlooked the gardens. Gus likes to clamber onto the wooden slats and muscle me over to take up more than his share of the seat. On that warm summer birthday night, the park was as beautiful as ever, the air heavy with the perfume of wisteria. Tracy led me toward the western border of the garden. It's not a pony, is it? You know, we don't have room for a pony. That's just a fertilizer smell. Anyway, you already got a pony. His name is Gus. She stopped when we reached a particular bench and called my attention to a small plaque, a dedication plate. Tracy had made a donation to the Central Park Conservancy for which she was allowed to dedicate a park bench. This one was mine. The inscription read, "For Mike Fox and Gus, true New Yorkers." My first thought was, how amazing, a perfect gift. My second thought was, I don't know how much longer I'll be able to walk this far with Gus. Years ago, before the tumor on my spine had even announced itself, my legs were weakening, my endurance diminishing. Parkinson's is a thief, and now it was taking away something as simple but precious as the ability to walk my dog in the park. By unknowingly placing such a wonderful prize just beyond my grasp, the greatest gift Tracy had given me that night was incentive. Flash forward. It's the day after Tracy's dinner party for my 57th birthday. Today, I'm back in the Conservatory Garden, the perfect location for a rehab graduation victory lap, or more like a victory straightaway. I'm going to attempt my first short walk on my own, away from any facility, without a cane, walker, or the assistance of an aide. Skylar's with me, along with her boyfriend, Will Savage, an Ivy League baseball phenom who's just been drafted by the Detroit Tigers. They push me up Fifth Avenue in my rental wheelchair, hopefully soon to be returned, to the entrance of the garden. Very near my bench, I rise from the chair, place my feet an appropriate distance apart, shift my weight from side to side like I'm about to swing a 9-iron, pick up my right foot and press forward. Heel first, then transfer weight, and the left foot follows. Now I'm showboating. I make it about 100 feet or so, when, detecting a wobble in my step, Will hustles to catch up with me. Instead of grabbing my arm, he offers his own, and after a semi-stumble, I gratefully take it. He instinctively understands that the situation does not call for him to rescue me, but for me to reach out to him. It's a subtle distinction, but a big difference. I rest my hand on Will's arm for a second or two, then let go and carry on. Skylar captures the moment on her iPhone. We send the video to Dr. Theodore, with whom I stay in regular contact. He'll love it. He can put it on his reel. I knew the recovery would be a slog, but I didn't fully anticipate how aware I would be of my state of mind, my emotions. Optimism has always been the norm for me, but perhaps with age or through the rigors of this experience, I now find it easier to drift into melancholy, to lose my enthusiasm for the task at hand. On this day, I'm relieved that my walk in the park with Skylar and Will provides an antidote. In fact, as much as I can immerse myself in their stories, their victories, and their lives, my own becomes much less important. It's a welcome shift. Everyone, family and friends, have been really supportive. They remind me that I have a life to step back into, which encourages me to be forward-thinking. Chapter 14, Breaking Dad. During my recent months of rehab, in between morning and afternoon therapy sessions at Mount Sinai, my golf buddies, Harlan Coben and George Stephanopoulos, regularly drop by my apartment to have lunch with me. My golf buddies are encouraging. They buoy me with their friendship and company and remind me that the quicker I heal, the sooner I return to the links. Today will be the last time we get together like this, because rehab has ended, summer is arriving, and busy family schedules will disrupt our routine. Harlan calls ahead with his usual order. Chicken noodle soup, he requests. Yeah, I can set that up, I promise. See you at 1. At a towering, to me, 6'5", with a clean-shaven dome, Harlan would be intimidating if he wasn't so affable. We blather about golf and politics, anything but my spine. It may have to do with the fact that he's one of the world's best-selling novelists, but he tells a good story over a bowl of soup, usually related to his far-ranging business travels. Netflix adapted a few of his books into a wildly popular miniseries, and he's been zipping back and forth between production locations in Europe. Harlan is especially beloved by the French. Pourquoi? He shrugs. What can I say? I'm the Jerry Lewis of mystery writers. George stops by at the end of his workday at Good Morning America. Still trim and fit with more hair than a Portuguese water dog, he was first introduced to me back in the 90s, in preparation for my role as a young political operative in the American president. The similarities went beyond our shared lack of height. I had a lot of hair then, too. You never know with George. He could have just had pancakes with Trump or shared a cab with Andrew Cuomo. Harlan and I goad him into divulging his political insights and opinions, and he never disappoints. Whatever Harlan and I have for lunch, George has the healthier version. But he's always a sucker for a popsicle, usually lemon-lime, my go-to palate cleanser. Before I head downstairs for my afternoon workout, and George departs for home to take a nap, and Harlan goes back to his place to bang out another novel, we talk golf. A big PGA tournament is coming up at Harlan's club, and he invites the two of us to walk the course with the pros. I realize I can't possibly walk the course anytime soon, so we don't discuss it much further. A few weeks later, Harlan, George, and I will watch the tournament together, not at the club, but on the TV in my living room. Harlan brings over official PGA programs. We're in awe of these pros who are absolutely shredding the course that has humbled and exposed us so many times. Golf only makes good television if you're a golfer. But for those that love the game, it stokes a fire to play again. Just can't wait to get out there and swing a club. As events transpire, my return to the game will not happen as soon as I'd hoped. Unexpectedly, I'll soon find myself in a bunker with no way to dig out. Life, already in flux, is about to change again. What remains constant is my friendship with these two guys. They will be there for me, round for round, no matter how deep the rough. My aides decamp. Eventually, I regain my independence. Free to move in a world beyond the distance between one end of an antiseptic hospital corridor and the other. At last, I'm able to stroll around the apartment without assistance. My gait is better. I progress from walker to cane to elbow-holding aid to hands-free trucking down the hallway. Now I'm able to say goodbye to my daytime aides. I've grown fond of Belinda, the Richard Petty of home healthcare. On her final day with me at home, I offer my appreciation and tell her I hope to see her again, but miles away from a wheelchair. Marcus, the rehab cheerleader, is pressed into duty one more weekend to travel with us to Aquinas' graduation. Aquinas took a gap year before attending university. Skylar graduated last spring from a liberal arts college in California. It's a sprawling campus, so I need Marcus to steer me in a wheelchair. I trust him to make sure I don't miss a beat. As expected, on an early summer day in North Carolina, the heat is oppressive, and with no breeze, it's constant and inescapable. But Marcus is steady and uncomplaining. When I introduce him to Aquinas, I'm happy that she takes the time out to thank him. My beautiful daughter beams with accomplishment. I'm so proud of her that I don't give a shit about who sees me in a wheelchair. Aquinas is just relieved that I'm able to attend the graduation so soon after surgery. Dude, I'm so happy you're here. You look good. Yeah, I used to be on TV. She laughs and expresses regret that she couldn't make it up to Baltimore to visit me at Johns Hopkins. I tell her that I understood. The final semester before graduation was hectic, and I wanted her to concentrate on reaching this day. So much of what's important in life seems to sneak up on me. So much time and energy invested in getting ready to go someplace and then getting there, that the sensation of being there is a revelation. Look where I am. Look what happened. It's a blur, like living several lives at once. As Aquinas accepts her diploma, I consider not just my journey to this milestone, but hers, the unique and demanding path she created for herself. Charming, affable, and lovely, with what I call her resting on the beach face, Aquinas is smarter than two of me. And tougher than I'll ever be. Her work ethic is staggering. A ballet dancer since she was four, classically trained at the School of American Ballet and later Ballet Academy East, Aquinas has reached a professional level. I cringe at the thought that I may have been so occupied with my travails and injuries that I never fully recognized the sacrifice, physical and emotional and temporal, that Aquinas has made over the years. There were many missed holiday vacations when she and Skylar danced in George Balanchine's The Nutcracker with the New York City Ballet. Sky dropped out of dance at the end of fifth grade, but Aquinas persisted in a big way. She felt that if she took even a few days off, she would lose her flexibility and be out of shape. By the time she was 15, the School of American Ballet required an even greater effort, essentially full-time. To continue, Quinn would have to be homeschooled or transfer her academic education to the professional children's school. She chose to remain at her current high school and instead change ballet schools. Still, she wanted to make dance her career. She maintained a six-day-a-week schedule, attending classes during the day and the Ballet Academy East at night. She applied to the college of her dreams and was accepted, but she knew she had to be all in for ballet or all in for college. She decided to defer college for a year and went to Miami as a student apprentice with the Miami City Ballet. And at the end of that commitment, she was offered a job with the Washington Ballet Studio Company in D.C. It was clear that she had succeeded in her goal of becoming a professional ballet dancer. The offer was there. She weighed carefully the choice between ballet and university. In the end, she decided she would dance at college. By the time Aquina was a freshman in high school, we were aware of the toll that ballet was taking on her body. Calves and hip flexors were stressed to the point of agony, and she dislocated her shoulder a couple of times, broke her foot, and fractured the tibial plateau in her knee. While the knee was still slowly recovering, she had surgery to repair her shoulder. It was painful. She was seeing a chiropractor regularly and an acupuncturist weekly. This treatment was essential. Also, dancers' toes take a savage beating. She'd wear out a new pair of pointe shoes every few days. One particular brand of shoe caused her to lose both of her big toenails. She left them on Skylar's pillow, which wasn't appreciated. After the graduation ceremony, Marcus guides my chair to a shady patch of lawn next to the chapel, within which Aquina has just received her diploma. Tracy, Sam, Sky, and Esme are there, ready to take some pictures. Tracy says, "Aquina, let's get a shot with you and your dad." Aquina puts her hand on my arm and bends down for the photo. I smile. "If it's okay, I'll stand for this one." And I do. And she hugs me. Independence Day. July arrives and my family and I resume our normal summer schedule. We use our home on Long Island as a midsummer base. I continue therapy on my own and my walking improves. Slowly and steadily, although I've granted myself the assistance of an industrial four-pronged mega cane. The prongs may not be the best idea, because they encourage me to cheat and use the cane as a crutch, as opposed to a metronomic device to measure stride. But I get along and I keep up with the group. Oh, but there is one incident. After enjoying dinner at a hip restaurant in Sag Harbor, I pay the check and we make our way toward our waiting car. We have to pass through the crowded bar with several archways and loose carpets. All of this visual busyness triggers one of those mini moments of panic that cause overstriding, which degrades into festination. Alarmed by the threshold of an arch, my shuffling feet trip up on a carpet edge and I tip forward, extending my hands to cushion my fall. Unfortunately, one hand is still holding the cane and my thumb gets trapped and bent awkwardly, tearing a ligament. I rise, embarrassed, tempted to offer a sheepish bow to the now staring diners in the establishment. "Is that Michael J. Fox?" I check out my thumb. Yep, it's officially damaged. Later, I make plans with a hand surgeon to have the tendon reattached. In early August, my family and I board a ferry for 2 weeks on Martha's Vineyard, blissfully unaware that the thumb incident presages something worse. On the positive side, I'm discouraged from overusing the cane, and as a result, my stride is much improved. I love this island. After more than 20 summers vacationing here, I know it like home ground. Tracy and the family have been coming to the vineyard since she was born. They established their summer idol in the town of Aquina, which, not coincidentally, is also the name of our recently graduated daughter. Every day we make our way to the beach, an unspoiled strand of gorgeous New England shoreline, protected by towering dunes. Long before I had any problem with my spine, these dunes challenged me. I'd have to climb up one side of the monstrous wave of sand on all fours and slide down the other on my butt towards the ocean. We have a silly game we play at the start of every summer season, kind of a family tradition. The first person to the crest of the dune throws their arms in the air and shouts, "I'm king of the mountain!" On my post-surgery return, I decide that I'm taking this year's honors. I'm under doctor's orders not to carry anything, so I take the opportunity to hobble past my beach umbrella chair blanket and towel-toting wife and children. Even with this advantage, I still have to negotiate the last part of the ascent on all fours. I'm feeling great until I reach the sandy summit. Once there, I sputter out the obligatory declaration of royalty, only to find I can't throw my arms in the air without tweaking my spine, losing my balance, and tipping over. That takes the swagger out of the whole thing, and I ignominiously slither down the seaside slope of the dune. Even so, I am the first one on the beach. It's good to be king. I look at the sunlight flickering off the shore break and I see a man tossing a soggy tennis ball to an enthusiastic border collie. I miss Gus. It feels odd that he's not with us. After all, this is his turf. This is where we found each other. But his aversion to the water has never changed. He really hates it. And he's especially distrustful of the ocean. He's not crazy about hot sand either, and he can never find enough shade. So to avoid stressing him out, he's at a doggy camp in Connecticut, while we enjoy the sun and waves in Massachusetts. Martha's Vineyard is a dichotomy. It is verdant, with country roads that ramble under exquisite leafy arbors, and roll past grassy meadows dotted with sheep. The caveat is, we're not the only ones who love it. Over the summer, the vineyard receives hordes of tourists on bicycles, mopeds, cars, and trucks, clogging the streets of Edgartown and Vineyard Haven with Boston-style traffic jams. But save for a short list of locals, many of whose surnames can be found on the Mayflower's manifest, we're all tourists on the vineyard, so we don't complain. I'm thriving here. Leaving the island is the last thing on my mind. Until a script arrives from my agent, with an interesting offer. Spike Lee is producing a film by a young protege, Stefan Bristol. See You Yesterday is a time travel movie, a nod to Back to the Future, with a compelling twist. A teenage girl, reeling from the death of her older brother at the hands of police, manufactures the means for time travel in order to reverse history and save him. The filmmakers want me for a cameo in the role of the girl's science teacher, who is dubious about time travel. It's a small part, a bit of a wink, but I like it. It's a low-stress way to ease back into work. My scenes are set to shoot on the Monday of our last week in Martha's Vineyard. It's a one-day commitment with travel days on either side. I'll easily make it back in time to close out the vacation with Tracy, Esme, and Aquina. Skylar has work to do in the city, so we'll travel to New York together on Sunday. Legend of the Fall. Parents with multiple children are often asked if they have a favorite. I always say, yeah, whichever one I'm with. Tonight I'm with Skylar, and I couldn't be happier. We sit at the kitchen table, eating takeout Italian and discussing Skye's fledgling career. She works for a clinic that provides support for adolescents with anxiety disorders. Sensitive and empathetic, Skye cares a lot about the kids she works with. Some people see the world around them. Skylar feels it. She makes me want to sing the theme song to the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Curious about how to progress in her field, or perhaps in another, we discuss her options and opportunities at length. She has a secondary interest in working in communications and children's television, and she's also considering getting her master's in health and public policy. It's a good talk, and I wrap it up by reminding her, well, Skye, you don't have to figure out the rest of your life tonight. She laughs and tosses her napkin on her plate. Well, then when will I figure it out? That I don't know, I answer. I guess there's no time like the future. We clear our dishes. Hey, Skye, do me a favor. Sure. I reach up to the shelf behind the kitchen table and retrieve my folded script pages. Do you mind running tomorrow's lines with me? She smiles and says I'd love to. I used to be able to take an entire script for Family Ties, look at it for 5 minutes, and know every word. Not so much anymore. Maybe it's PD or maybe it's just being 57. Who knows? I'm fairly solid on these lines, but practice never hurts. And it's fun. My daughter reads the other characters' lines and without being too weird about it, almost performs them. Hey, wait a minute, I say. What about acting? Didn't you take a couple of classes last year? This cracks her up. Yeah, but God, no, absolutely not. That was for fun, not for profit. I couldn't take the pressure. Yeah, it gives you Parkinson's. We go through the scenes a few more times. It's getting late, so I let her off the hook. Honey, I'm up at 6:15. I gotta get some sleep. She pauses. I don't think I should leave. I should stay and be here for you in the morning to fix your breakfast. You should go back to your apartment. You have to be at work early yourself. I offer a slight smile. Look, I know you and Mom talked about this and decided I shouldn't be alone, but I need to do this by myself. She packs up the leftovers and stores them in the fridge. It's not like some kind of conspiracy to spy on you or babysit you or keep you from living your life. We just care about you. We love you. I love you too, and I love that you care about me. But you can care about me without having to take care of me. After Skye collects her bag, we walk to the door. With lingering hesitation, she asks, are you sure? In a gentle tone, I respond, stop, you have to go. It's late, so don't take the subway. Take an Uber. I'll be fine. I'll call you on the way back from the set tomorrow. We hug as the elevator arrives. She steps in. I listen to it rumble down to the lobby. and look around at the empty apartment. I am alone. This is what happens. The next morning, I set out for the kitchen to grab breakfast. Not much, maybe a piece of toast and a swallow of juice. There will be no coffee. Tracy's coffee maker was engineered by Mercedes-Benz, and I never read the manual. I'm wearing sweatpants and the Tom Petty t-shirt I slept in. In less than 2 hours, I won't have that shirt anymore. An EMT with a pair of shears will cut it off on my way to the emergency room. But in the moment, I am pleased. Right chuffed, as the English would say, to be going to work. I'm in excellent form, my walking smooth. Emboldened, I pick up the pace a bit just because I can, realizing there is no one there to chide me. I kick it up another notch and turn the corner into the kitchen, a sharp right. I steady myself by lightly touching the doorframe, not for support, but for balance. Then I plow ahead. 3 steps into the breakfast nook, I execute a quick left to avoid the banquette, and that's when it all goes sideways. Something distracts me. I lose control, 1 foot crossing over the other foot. I stop too suddenly, slide on the tile, and down I go. Get up. Nope, I can't get up. I delay that impulse and instead survey my cranium for any cracks or contusions, my face for any broken bones or teeth. No blood. At least I avoided serious head-to-floor contact. My brain seems okay, no headache, and I don't feel nauseous. I am, however, a little confused. I can't understand how I could have done this to myself. Very quickly, my daze is surpassed by fear. I need help, but there's no one here. I'm alone. Just like I planned. What a genius. My left arm is definitely broken. Not a clean break. There's no locus of pain, just a dull ache that soon becomes radiating misery. Although getting up is not a possibility, I have to make it to the phone. Scooching and slithering, I arrive at the wall phone, where my worst fears are realized. I can't reach the cord. When I shift my right glute to take pressure off my throbbing left arm, I feel my cell phone tucked in the rear pocket of my sweatpants. I want to call Tracy, but I don't know if I should. She can't help me from Martha's Vineyard, and I don't want her to worry and freak out. I don't have the heart to call Skylar. I know her so well, she'll put this on herself. This is my mess, and no one is better at cleaning up my messes than Nina. I dial and wake her. Nina, call the production office. Tell them I don't think I can make it today. Something's messed up. She's still sleepy, but has a quick read on the problem. I'm guessing you're symptomatic and you don't think your drugs are going to kick in. She assures me, it'll be okay. We'll adjust your meds. You're going to be great today. No, I fell. I think I broke my arm. It's bad. Shit. Nina throws her jeans over her pajamas, and she's in a taxi racing uptown within minutes of my call. The time it takes for Nina to get to me, I put to good use, berating myself. I come close to crying. What stays the tears is my seething, self-directed anger. Idiot! Do you realize what you've done? You screwed it all up. Your surgery, your health, the rehab, all the time and effort people put into you. God damn it, you threw it all away! So many thoughts race through my head. And what about the movie? I should be leaving in a few minutes for the set. What's Spike gonna say? What will Stefan do? Hire someone else? 5 minutes before crew call? This is a disaster. They're gonna have to shut down today. And that's on me. So much is on me. How will Tracy and the kids feel? They've invested their love and attention in my recovery. Tracy toasted my determination to heal, and now I may have wrecked the whole thing. How can I be so selfish? My family's put up with so much crap. They begged me to be careful, and I laughed it off. I may have done permanent damage to myself. Not just to my arm, I may have hurt my spine. 4 months since I had major back surgery, and I gambled my health and the security of my family by being a fool. Nina arrives and finds me still on the floor. Have you been down here the whole time? She says, bending to help me up. Just don't touch my left arm. Don't even say left arm. She looks at the appendage, misshapen and lifeless, and winces. How's it look, I ask. She gently lifts me by the right arm into a chair. I'm calling an ambulance. No, I protest. No ambulance. I don't want to make a big deal out of this. We'll take a cab to the hospital. I shift and my left elbow taps the back of the chair. The bolt of pain I experience is so searing, so profound, that my mother in Canada feels it. The noise this produces for me is appropriate to the occasion. I'm calling an ambulance, Nina repeats. Now it all deteriorates into a fog of pain. I do remember two ridiculously good-looking EMTs showing up in my apartment, one female and one male, straight out of a Dick Wolf series. They ask if I want morphine. Yes, please. My next clear memory isn't until late that afternoon, as I'm wheeled out of surgery. A doctor, still in scrubs, approaches the gurney and looks into my squinting eyes. Mr. Fox? I slowly nod. I think so. I'm Dr. Glatz, chief of orthopedic surgery here at Mount Sinai. I just fixed your arm. I try to focus on her blurry form. Was it bad? She smiles. It wasn't good, but the surgery was successful. That arm is rebuilt to last. She shows me a confusing picture of what looks like an erector set placed inside a limb. What am I looking at? That's an x-ray of your arm, she says, with a stainless steel plate and 19 screws. She calls it a spiral fracture of the humerus, which means that the arm was twisted in the fall, like wringing a wet towel, only with bone and flesh. Shattered from shoulder to elbow, it took meticulous surgery, plus a half pound of cutlery to repair. As I will find out, a broken humerus is no fucking joke. Chapter 15, A Wing and a Proverb. I wake up in another hospital room. I'm thinking about my phone call with Tracy last night. She'd already spoken with the doctors and Nina was keeping her up to date, so as usual, she was more informed about my situation than I was. We'll be there as soon as we can, she said. Everyone's getting packed up. We're just waiting for a couple of seats to open up on tomorrow's flight. No, don't pack yet, I told her. I think you should stay. You look forward to the vineyard all winter, and the weather is supposed to be fantastic the rest of the week. Your mom's there. It's perfect. I don't want another one of my freaking health crises to blow up one more family vacation. Stay. Enjoy. Please. I'll see you and the girls in a few days. The silence on the phone told me she still needed to convince him. Honey, it's just a broken arm. It's a badly broken arm, she corrected me. Well, there's no such thing as a goodly broken arm. I heard a faint laugh. Look, Nina's with me. Scott is coming to the hospital tomorrow. The Shankers promised to stop by. I'm golden. I love you. Go to the beach. I get about 8 hours sleep in 2 hour intervals, during which time I am stuck and restuck with needles, either repositioning the IV or drawing blood. Between the surgery in Baltimore and now this thing, over the last 4 months, I've been jabbed so many times and my once beautiful veins have been forced into hiding. A nurse pushes the door open. Good morning, Mr. Fox. How are you feeling? Perforated. I brought you something. The morphine hangover is making me goofy. A blood pressure sleeve. I've always wanted one. She holds up a magazine. I'm sorry, I can't see that without my glasses. She brings it closer. It's People magazine. On the cover, Michael J. Fox and Tracy Pollan, our 30-year love story. I'm intrigued. We did the interview with our friend Jess Cagle, along with a photo spread in July. We even snuck Gus into a few shots. It's weird to see the finished product for the first time in this setting. It belongs in another life, a different world, a world in which Tracy and I are celebrities and we have a Hollywood marriage. Actually, we live in New York, and when we're in L.A., we don't go anywhere near Hollywood. Not even to visit my star on the sidewalk, which, if you're interested, is on Hollywood Boulevard between La Brea and Highland. At the moment, I'm not feeling the stardust. This is not a Hollywood moment. It's not my latest role. If it is, I'm going to fire my agent. It is strange to reconcile this shiny, happy persona staring out from the glossy cover of a magazine with this busted lump of a 57-year-old human. Not gliding along a red carpet, but lying in a hospital bed. The nurse puts the magazine on the bedside table and goes about her routine, with a velocity born of skillful repetition. She comes at me with a blood pressure cuff and swipes a thermometer wand across my forehead. As the sleeve tightens on my arm, I inquire, "What time is checkout?" The machine reaches max pressure, gives a wheeze, and releases my arm. "You're staying at least another night." "Two nights for a busted arm?" She scribbles something on my chart and answers, "I'm sure the doctor will go over the game plan when she comes by after breakfast." The nurse turns to leave. "Any special food requests?" "Edible would be fine. Thanks for the magazine." "Oh, that's mine. Can you please sign it before you leave?" "Sure. No problem." I glance over at the magazine. Our 30th wedding anniversary was a month ago. We celebrated it, but we didn't make a big deal out of the number, even though we were quietly impressed that we'd made it this far. It's funny and a little ironic that when we got married in front of close friends and family at a small country inn in Vermont, people panned our wedding. We denied access to the magazine and all other media. 30 years ago, pre-social media, pre-Instagram, pre-Twitter, pre-Facebook, we had a reasonable expectation that we could have an experience that was limited to just the people who were in that room. Frustrated by our refusal to offer up this private moment as a public spectacle, they projected the chaos outside the compound, crowds of onlookers, photographers, helicopters whirring above, to mean that our entire day, the ceremony and celebration afterward, all clear and precious memories, represented an epic fail by us. They said it was a complete fiasco. Nuptials in hell. The marriage was doomed. We'll take the anniversary edition as a correction. I'm soon confronted with a bowl of oatmeal, Jurassic raisins, and syrupy apple juice. I don't know where to start. Thanks, I'll eat it later, I lied to the orderly. My goofiness is giving way to a mild but gathering sense of foreboding. I'm uneasy. Something has changed. I just haven't processed what it is yet. I pick raisins out of the goo. Breakfast is over. As if on cue, Dr. Glatz and an associate stride in, accompanied by Nina. The doctor reintroduces herself. Good morning, I'm Lisa Glatz. You may not remember meeting me yesterday. Surprisingly, I do recognize her as the orthopedic surgeon who performed the operation. You showed me a picture of something in an x-ray. That's right. I emailed it to Nina, so you have it on file. A souvenir. Received, Nina says, and then to me, it's horrifying. Dr. Glatz carries on. I've spoken with Dr. Theodore. He knows what happened? Nina says, I called him yesterday as soon as we got to the ER, so I could connect him with the doctors here. I examined the site of the spinal surgery, Dr. Glatz says, and told Dr. Theodore that I saw no signs of trauma or damage to the incision. It's healed nicely, so we're both confident that it's not a factor. So in basic terms, my back is okay then? Your spine is fine, Dr. Glatz responds. And your bones are strong, like a 25-year-old's. But the impact was violent. A spiral fracture like yours will take time to heal, usually 4 to 6 weeks. We'll coordinate rehab with the folks at Johns Hopkins to cover both issues. A physical therapist will come by your room later today to go through everything you'll need to do. Make sure to follow the instructions carefully. Damn. More rehab. I'm gonna need rehab from rehab. She heads out the door. I'll stop by again tomorrow. Looks like I'll be here, I say with that much enthusiasm. Nina pulls out her phone. Oh, before I forget, I called your brother Steve in Canada. I asked him to call your mom and let her know you're okay. You should text her, but don't include this. Nina taps her phone, pulls up the image from Dr. Glatz, and turns the screen toward me. God, that is horrifying, I concur. Creepy, right? A ghostly gray and black image. A skeletal arm with multiple fractures up and down the bone, like fingers of lightning. It would shatter into 1,000 pieces if it were not for those pins and the plate anchoring the humerus to the shoulder. And look at this. She shows me another image on her phone. This one is more lurid, vivid, and explicit. My first impression is meat. It's the exterior view, in living color. A long, jagged, nasty incision on my bruised and swollen left arm, since covered by layers of bandage and surgical tape, and hidden in a sling. The injury tomorrow will have consequences. Dr. Glatz tells me later that the stress of the orthopedic surgery alone will weaken me. My balance will be off. I'll have to reapproach walking and prepare to learn a different set of skills to meet a new set of challenges. The work begins all over again. I wasn't looking for another health problem, but one found me. So now I'm dealing with Parkinson's, a spinal condition, and a broken down wing. Every picture tells a story. I'm sorry, I should have stayed, Skylar says. In those desperate minutes I spent wallowing on the kitchen floor, I knew that this would weigh heavily on Skylar, whose reputation for compassion goes beyond the family to school and her coworkers. Don't tell me if I was there, it still would have happened anyway, she insists. It would have, I counter. No, just by my being there, the timing would have been different. I sit down in a hospital chair and guide Skylar to sit across from me at the foot of the bed. Wanting to avoid a prolonged rehashing of the butterfly effect, I assure her, and it would have been something else. I could have left the oven on or tripped in the bathroom and cracked my head open on the sink. Things are gonna happen. She flops back on the bed and stares at the ceiling, her long hair spreading out over the hospital sheets. I still think about what you went through in Baltimore, dude. It was so disturbing. I wanted to help you, but I couldn't. I felt so powerless. She raised her head from the mattress. I know if I'd stayed with you Sunday night, I could have done something. As I listened to Sky, I realized that she had